I often think of the line in Macbeth, light thickens and the crow makes wing to the rooky wood. Good things of day begin to droop and drowse, whilst night's black agents to their praise do rouse.
Gerald O'Brien lives in an old farmhouse on a hill above the West Cork town of Skibbereen. He's a former post office worker, he's a historian, and a friend of mine. I'm sitting with him by his fire. Night is falling, and rubbing his hands together in the warm glow, Gerald is thinking about darkness and how we've abandoned it.
The events associated with night were blacker and more sinister. The darker things, well, that's how they take their name, isn't it? Because they are dark. At the same time, there is a quest for mystery, which will not be satisfied in too bright a light condition. With the electrification of rural Ireland, it has destroyed the experience of night in the modern age. Several generations, perhaps without realizing it or knowing it, have been deprived of the experience of night. It's an experience that has been robbed from the younger people because the day has been doubled in length, the active day. And it is hard on the eyes and on the ears, and people nowadays remain hyperactive from when they get up in the morning till perhaps 12 midnight when they're turning in for bed.
So you can remember then in this very house before electricity in the 1960s, you can remember a darkness into which you can no longer plunge unless if there's a power cut.
Oh yes, I do. I remember it well, and I miss it a lot nowadays, because I haven't had it in 40 or 50 years.
Emily Dickinson, we grow accustomed to the dark. We grow accustomed to the dark when light is put away, as when the neighbour holds the lamp to witness her goodbye. A moment we uncertain step for newness of the night, then fit our vision to the dark and meet the road erect. And so of larger darknesses, those evenings of the brain when not a moon disclose a sign or star come out within, the bravest grope a little and sometimes hit a tree directly in the forehead. But as they learn to see, either the darkness alters or something in the sight adjusts itself to midnight, and life steps almost straight.
Last week, we floated over a broad afternoon with anticipation, joy, and grief. Now we're growing accustomed to the dark as the night wraps around us. Our night, this night, will be a time to dwell on mysteries, on fears for our loved ones, on fears for our own souls. It'll be a time of strange sounds, ghostly visits, and dark wanderings.
There are a lot of things that I'm drawn to photograph and to paint, any areas that are close to darkness. And the way the camera will pick things up, you'll get these ambiguous shapes just floating in the darkness.
Francis Matthews is a painter who's well accustomed to the dark. He paints night scenes of Dublin, brightly lit street corners or marginal spaces you might miss as you walk by them, or laneways you might prefer to avoid. such as the one he brings me to on a recent walk around his night haunts.
We've got an end of a terrace, so a big blank wall to our left with a little bit of graffiti on it, a street light lighting it up nicely. There's that, a bin on the right as well, kind of casually in the middle of the lane. And then we've got ahead of us another lane that we can see part of the way down. And I quite like that, when you can see only some of the way down, makes me want to explore a little bit more.
What we've got here is almost like the set of a drama.
Yeah, that is another thing I kind of like at night, that they look like empty film sets sometimes, you know? That kind of spot lighting. It looks like a place where something could unfold, you know?
It also looks a little bit like a Francis Matthews painting.
It does. A friend has texted me on his way home saying he feels like he's inside one of my paintings. I like that it gives some people a different appreciation of a laneway or something, or somewhere they might have not paid any attention to before, you know. I crossed the street to get a photo of this one.
I stand beside Francis as he takes photos on his phone. He singles out one building or one lamplit spot and captures these from as many angles as he can.
Like, when I photograph on a night, I might take about 100 photos or something. And when I get them home on the computer, I'll go through them, get rid of the ones that are a little out of focus and stuff, and then pull out the ones that I find most interesting. Then I'll print them out. At that stage, maybe two will be good enough.
One or two of these photos will be the model for the oil painting he'll create back in his studio in the daylight hours.
I've done a 12-hour walk all night before, and I did one on the winter solstice one time. Walked from Portrane down to Sandy Mount or something like that, and just photographing all night. After 17 hours of walking, my feet were very sore. So on my way into town, starting to see some bakers opening up some of their shops, and I bumped into an astronomer that was setting up his telescope and was looking at some stars. I had a look, and it was a nice, nice adventure.
A lot of people possibly will think of sunlight and bright light when they think of painting. You have shunned the light, Francis, and you've turned to the dark. And I'm wondering, are there other artists that have done this?
There's some of the Renaissance ones. I think Caravaggio and stuff used a lot of darkness in his paintings, and maybe Rembrandt as well. A lot of candlelight and stuff like that. There's something that appeals to me more about the nature of how the city is lit by artificial light. There's more of a contrast between the light and dark. Occasionally, I do every once in a while paint a painting that has daylight in it, but normally it's a narrow laneway, or there's a bit of a tunnel or something, or there is a combination of dark and light in it.
On a dark street next to Ranelagh, Francis is admiring a shabby gable end of a house which is almost hidden in the gloom.
It's not painted, it's a little grimy, and I can set up a photograph where I can see that kind of grimy wall, and then I'm looking down the street towards the spire and towards places that are looking after their appearance, you know, so there's a nice contrast.
So you're saying you'd like to include a bit of that wall section with the view that we have of Ranelagh, the junction here. There's a bright spire shop at the bottom of the road, people coming in and out, people on their phones. It's busy. But around the corner, this section of the wall could be an area where people get sick if they've had too much to drink, or pee if they've had too much to drink, or get up to something. It's a kind of a just around the corner, you never know what you might meet feel to it.
Yeah, I quite like making a painting that's split down the middle, where fully one half of it is that place where people are hiding away from other people to do whatever they want to do, and then the more public area, and kind of given equal importance to both in the one painting. I quite like showing one against the other, you know.
Behind the facades of these buildings, people are asleep or getting ready for bed. They might see the painter pausing briefly under the orange street lamp like a fox. They might wonder what he's doing. Or maybe like the woman in Lucy Caldwell's story, Night Waking, they might suddenly be aware of a presence or a sound or something that disturbs their sleep.
Out of nowhere, you are suddenly awake, heart pounding. Nothing. The baby is next to you in the bed, asleep. In the orange glow of the salt lamp, the room's shadows are still. There is no noise from your son's room. It's the creak of a footstep in the wooden hallway, the sound of a footstep that's trying not to creak. You know the ley lines of the flat, the trusted navigable paths, the faulty joists and the timber flooring, guaranteed to wake a sleeping baby, even when that baby will sleep through the full blare of police sirens on the road outside. It's summer, so the heating's off. It can't be the pipes or radiators clicking to life. It's summer, so the balcony door is open to let air into your airless flat. You're on the third floor, so it's always seemed safe enough. Your breathing sounds noisy. Your heart, too, leaping like a trapped thing in your chest. The baby snuffles and rustles and turns onto her tummy. Was that another footstep? You listen with your fingertips, with every hair of your head. You locked the door last night, you're sure of it. Or rather, didn't fully lock it as the chub lock has been sticking, but flicked the snib downwards to disable the Yale. Your husband's away for 2 nights, of which this is the first. You don't always bother doing the blinds with the evenings so long. Has someone been watching? You know more than you mean to about the families opposite, the dioramas of their lives. Has someone who knows you, knows your husband, seen on his Facebook or Instagram that he's away? You listen, you listen. Your whole body aches with listening.
The moon's my constant mistress, and the lovely elf my marrow, the flaming drake and the night crow make me music to my sorrow.
The group of singers, Landless, have joined us throughout this series on Morning, Noon and Night. For this episode, they recorded 4 lines of an anonymous poem, Tom o' Bedlam, a so-called mad song, a lone outsider roaming the countryside with nothing but the moon for a companion.
The moon's my constant mistress, and the lovely island my the flaming drake and the night crow make me music to my sorrow.
I used to be somewhat scared of the moon. I certainly associated a full moon with being a little bit unhinged or being a little bit unpredictable in my emotional self. Especially when I lived in Cork as a younger person, I remember walking home from maybe being out dancing or in a pub or at a play or something, and the moon watching me. I felt very watched and judged by the moon. It was something that was very intense.
Like many parents with a newborn baby, the poet Victoria Kenefick found herself spending many wakeful hours in the night, sometimes under the gaze of the moon.
My relationship with the moon definitely changed when my daughter came along. It became softer and there was a real sense of support from the moon. And I suppose this might sound very odd, but at 3 a.m. in the morning, you know, you will take any support you can get. Seeing the light from the moon gave me some sort of solace. And I suppose that image that, you know, the moon is shining on everyone. So it was kind of a sense of connection between me and my daughter and all of the other people up at crazy hours of the night.
Her poem, Night Baby, is a sonnet which looks at how a mother and her daughter get to know each other over many long nights.
Night Baby. I've never thought about the moon so much, considered it sister-like, watching us learn how to be together. You in my arms, perfect circle of your small mouth pressed to my breast. Lunar light from my phone, my own brain, the moon all shining. It's scary how big the night is, how small we are in it. Think of the others up with us, a night nation of milk and mouths, all fumbling towards each other in the dark, singing. The shape of you, a crescent against me, little planet exploring your phases. O moon, be good to her in the ebb and flow of monthly life. Lick the path clean. But for now, sweet night baby, rock with me.
Listening to your poem, Victoria, I wondered for the first time if babies themselves have any sense of the night or the dark. Was your daughter aware of the difference?
I think she was very aware of the dark. Very aware of it being a time where she needed to relax, and that was something that she really resisted. She didn't like being in the dark. She didn't like lying down. She didn't like going to sleep. And it was something we literally, you know, really had to teach her. And now, thankfully, she loves it, which is a great blessing.
How do you mean you had to teach her?
In all of the baby manuals that I read with great interest before she arrived, they really stressed the whole notion of trying to teach even very small babies the difference between night and day, and exposing them to daylight as much as you possibly can. So we were desperately trying to, you know, show her to the window and take her out and show her the sun and show her the sky to, I suppose, you know, help her to learn about the whole concept of night and day. She was certainly a different child at night. And I don't know whether that was because of our feelings around the night. She slept with us for a long time until she was about 7 or 8 months. And then we moved her into her own room when I went back to work.
And what about you? Many poets have found the nighttime to be the best time to write, but I'd say I'd go crazy.
You do go crazy, and you experience every possible emotion and every dark thought and every bad thing that has ever happened to you, everything that could be wrong with the baby. But you kind of get used to that, and you start to realise that that is part of who you are now. Somebody who worries about the well-being of somebody else, somebody who has to sacrifice maybe their own well-being and their own sleep for the sleep of another. And it is very hard, and it is very demanding. And I think poetry really saved me, as it has so many times before, from losing myself to the darkness and to the madness and to the resentment and to the anger, which was all there, you know, which was all there and is all normal and all acceptable. Your body doesn't go to sleep properly. You just hear the slightest little squeak or geek and you're up, and you mightn't want to be up. There's a brilliant line from a Sylvia Plath poem where she wakes cow heavy. And I was always mildly disgusted, if I may say, by that, because I was like, my goodness, why is she comparing herself to a cow or being, you know, cow heavy? And I think in many respects you do become, you know, an animal, or you do understand what it means to be an animal a bit more. And that made me, I suppose, feel out of control somewhat. But it was maybe looking at it from the perspective of a poet and looking at it as somebody who knew that there were people up with me, and trying to think, I suppose, of the moon eye view of the world, and that we're all, you know, together trying to get by, the mums and the dads and the parents and the non-parents and the people, the insomniacs. I thought about them a lot. So it kind of, I suppose, taught me empathy, really, more than anything else.
A mother and baby at night is the theme of a song recorded by Landless on their Bleaching Bones album. It's a 19th century song called The Female Convict. Not long shall the arms of affection enfold thee, not long shalt thou hang on thy mother's fond breast. Doomed to die in the morning, the mother is begging her baby not to sleep on their last night together.
Oh, sleep not, my babe, for the morn of tomorrow shall soothe me to slumber more tranquil than thine. The dark grave shall shield me from shame and from sorrow. No,
by Edward Thomas. Downhill I came, hungry and yet not starved, cold, yet had heat within me that was proof against the north wind, tired, yet so that rest had seemed the sweetest thing under a roof. Then at the inn I had food, fire and rest, knowing how hungry, cold and tired was I. All of the night was quite barred out except an owl's cry, a most melancholy cry, shaken out long and clear upon the hill. No merry note, nor cause of merriment, but one telling me plain what I escaped, and others could not that night, as in I went. And salted was my food and my repose, salted and sobered too by the bird's voice, speaking for all who lay under the stars, soldiers and poor, unable to rejoice.
Those beautiful Tawny Owls were recorded by the sound engineer Brendan Rehill on a visit to Norfolk. Their cry is exactly as the poet described, shaken out, long and clear. Brendan tells me that on a field recording trip, after walking around the owlless woods for ages, he'd given up and was on his way home, but left his recorder running just in case. When he heard them, he stood still and shortened his breath. It's a classic sound of the night, and it's a shame that we don't have Tawny Owls in Ireland. I almost recorded one once in Wales, very late on a sticky summer's night. I was with my friend Annie. She told me that the forest behind the house was full of owls. They'll probably keep you awake all night, she said. I begged Annie to take me into the forest so I could record them. We left the forest path and broke through ferns to reach a clearing.
Shine a torch on me.
We stood under the trees as baby owls flew high above our heads.
Oh my God. Oh yeah, look.
They sounded very un-owl-like.
I think it's a baby. I don't want to
felt let down, to be honest. And I imagine the parents were perched nearby with fat mice and voles jammed into their beaks, waiting to feed their young. Also, Annie and I were covered in midges, and I'd never encountered these before. I couldn't keep my microphone still as the midges were teeming all over my arms, neck, beard, eyebrows, and I was covered in sweat. It was disgusting. We turned back towards the house. Unlike Brendan, I switched off my recorder, and immediately, of course, there was a most majestic swoop of wings across the path. And a low made-for-TV hoot that was clearly warning us never to return again. Brendan Rehill recorded his Tony Owls in Foxley Wood, which sounds like a place from Enid Blyton's world. In this minute of slow radio, you'll hear the sounds of a bitter November wind, the owls, and a wonderful fox barking through the cold night. Out there, the night is dark. The owl's screech is lonely. The man recording it is probably cold and maybe even spooked by the sound of the barking fox. It's time to light up our homes, to sit around fires and draw ourselves closer together. It's time for company. Let's make room by this fire for the little Nunneen.
When the little Nunneen was in this house, she didn't have to compete with the radio or TV, nor with electricity. The change from day to night, and the change from night to day, to her would have been a wonder which eludes most other people.
We heard Gerald O'Brien earlier when he spoke about how our idea of the night has changed since electricity entered our homes. Gerald is in his 80s, and whenever I'm in Skibbereen, I visit him in his house above the town. We talk for hours. He can draw random historical connections between the local and the global, which makes the past seem closer to us.
My father was born in this house in 1890, just about 1875 it was built. I often think of that just 10 years after Lincoln's assassination.
Once Gerald told me a story about a mysterious night visitor to his house in his father's day, a woman who's now almost entirely erased from memory, the little Nunneen.
She would have been a lady of small stature, not too tall. And she was a travelling woman. She might spend the winter in the workhouse, but in the summertime she would travel around and was most welcome by the people who gave her food and accommodation. And it was quite an event, the arrival of the little nun. But I don't know why she was known as the little Nunneen, but she was. That was it. I just wondered now whether some nun might have given her cast-off clothes or something. There could be some little reason for that, you know. And of course, she would have got shelter and food in convents as well. So she would be aware as to how a nun dressed.
And so when they come, they tell stories, and she'd stay a night or two nights here sometimes.
Perhaps a night or two, she would stay a night or two and then move on. And she possibly had a little route of friendly houses, shall we say, that she would go on her routes.
What I like about it is the fact that we're in the room where she would appear.
Same room, the same walls, the same house, everything. And over there in that corner to the right of the fireplace, it was a thing called the settle bed. By day, people could sit and take their meals with the table near it. It would call four or five. It was long. And at night, then it became a bed. By raising the cover, which was the seat, and a mattress was under that, and there would be quite a comfortable night could be spent on the settle bed there. And when this little nun arrived, you see, it is quite possible that she could neither read nor write. But you must remember there was very few reading newspapers, and she may have had fairly recent stories from the areas that she had just visited and carried them with her. So that would have been her repertoire, perhaps news of bad harvests or accidents or good news. She spoke about everything. And Skibbereen eventually got a gaslight system. There were gas lamps installed along the streets. She would arrive, and of course she would go out, perhaps round about dusk. And one evening, my late father, he remembered her. He told me that she looked down into the valley and announced that the houses are lit up for the little Noneen. She perceived it as a personal welcome to herself, though they came on every night. It was like a miniature Manhattan to her. And then, sadly, she stopped coming. And they made inquiries, and they found out she had died. Unknown in life and unknown in death. Yes, yes.
Gerald told me that he didn't think the little Noneen sang any songs, but I'd love to hear a song written about her. The idea of the night visitor is one that fills many stories and songs. Think of the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet, or Heathcliff knocking on Cathy's window at night in Wuthering Heights. In folk music, the visitor is often a lover or the ghost of a lover, such as in the traditional night-visiting song, The Bay of Biscay. It tells the story of a sailor lost at sea, returning to haunt his lover at night. The souls of those drowned off boats were said to have no resting place.
My William sailed on board the tender, and where he is, I do not know. For some long years, I have been waiting since he has crossed the Bay of Biscay.
Changed me, and I am the ghost of
Peter Waring is the title character in a 1937 novel written by Forrest Reid. It's set in Newcastle, County Down, and is the story of Peter's boyhood and his first awkward love. He's fallen for an English girl named Catherine who visits Ireland for a summer. Peter is a sensitive soul and is drawn to a graveyard outside the village. One night, he brings Catherine with him, but his mind soon begins to wander. The graveyard at night becomes the thin place where the known and the unknown worlds can mingle.
The grassy country looked grey and insubstantial under the rising moon. The dark spire and the few trees we were aiming for were visible now, and in a little while we reached the low wall on which I had sat that afternoon. Only at this hour, with fantastic moonlight, the place itself seemed quite different. Its friendly, homely quality had vanished. It was colder, more remote, less welcoming, with something slightly equivocal in its beauty. "You don't want to go inside, I suppose," Catherine said dissuasively, and I guessed from the sound of her voice that she herself didn't want to be here at all. "It's not like a modern churchyard," I tried to reassure her. "There's nothing unpleasant, no bodies, nothing except a little dust and a few ghosts, perhaps." She shrugged her shoulders, and we stood in silence beside the wall. Down by the graveyard just beneath us, something was moving through the long grass. But I did not point this out to Catherine, though very likely it was only a rabbit. A fairy tale of Hans Andersen's came into mind, and I saw death, like an old gardener, floating over the wall, carrying a soul like a baby, folded in his arms, and I watched him lay it to sleep under the trees. I had forgotten all the details of the story, but I made a story for myself, and the moonlight on the grass and on the weather-worn gravestones, the black lurking shadows and the lonely moon-drenched church wove it into a mysterious loveliness. It seemed to me that something might very easily happen now that would bring a stranger, vaster world directly into relation with us. In that other world, I thought, they perhaps dreamed of this, just as we sometimes did of it, and one was no more unreal than the other.
Last week we heard two poems by Jane Clark from her collection When the Tree Falls, which was published by Blood Axe last autumn. In the collection, Jane reflects on, among other things, nursing her father through his last illness. So much happens in the night when it comes to caring for the sick and the dying. Jane introduces one of the poems set in one of those nights. It's called I've Got You.
Well, this was inspired by one of the nights when we were nursing my father at home before he died. So he was at home for 2 months when we nursed him. And I suppose anybody who's had this experience, the nights can be very long. And also there's a certain intimacy in those roles, which of course kind of changes the dynamic between the father and the daughter, and the father becomes in some way the child, but that the dynamic changes back and forth, and that was part of what I was exploring in the poem. I've got you. Through days of morphine and titbits to tempt his appetite, there's nowhere else to be. I hold his teacup to his lips, wash his face and the hands I rarely touched. During the night, old hurts and worries surface like stones in a well-tilled field. What time is it now? He asks on the hour. He sings to himself and murmurs lines he learned as a child. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. When he asks to get up, I hold his wrists, brace my weight against his. For a moment, he's confused. It's okay, Janie, I've got you. Go on now, you can stand.
Earlier in this programme, we heard Victoria Kenefic describing night through the eyes of a new discovery, a new baby in her arms. I was wondering if there's a sort of an opposite effect where you're nursing someone who is someone you've known all your life, so you know them intimately. Was your experience of night changed through nursing someone who was dying?
It's a lovely question. In those 2 months, I probably was more aware of night than I've ever been in my life, and more, you know, so much happened during those nights, you know, things that were worrying, things that were frightening, and also moments of great intimacy and moments of storytelling and singing. And so, yes, nighttime was very full time, because sometimes my father would sleep earlier in the evening and then he'd be awake at night. And also his dreams were very vivid because, of course, he was having some morphine. So he'd be telling you his dreams. And in his dreams, there were lots of stories. And so actually, I hadn't thought about this. And, you know, as you asked the question, I realized quite a few of these poems are set during the night, the poems with my father. You know, I hadn't been so aware of that. So, you know, when you say my experience with night, did it change it? I suppose it was a very important time and a very full time and a time I really valued. And particularly looking back, I really valued that I had the time with my father. It was very, because we took it in turns to sleep on a mattress beside his bed. So the night you were on, you had this closeness with them, and you were saying that maybe, you know, someone I knew all my life, but in some ways I didn't know him that well until then. I got to know him in another way then, and that was part of what was very precious about it.
If people were finishing their day of work and they'd hear the bell tolling in the church and they could come and gather for that evening prayer, which was a gathering of all those different monastic offices.
The Reverend Abigail Sines is the Dean's Vicar at Christ Church Cathedral in Dublin. She sometimes leads the prayers there at evensong, a service with beautiful words and music to mark the end of the day and the approach of night.
If we think about the service of evening prayer that we have now in our current prayer book, we find the roots of that going back to Cranmer in the time of the English Reformation. It had a very reflective feeling. So you were carried through these patterns and sets of psalms and scriptures and readings, and those are what brought you to the close of the day, sort of carried you to your home rest at the end of your working day. Before the ending of the day, Creator of the world, we pray that thou with wonted love wouldst keep thy watch around us while we sleep. O let no evil dreams be near or phantoms of the night appear. Our ghostly enemy restrain, lest aught of sin our bodies stain. Almighty Father, hear our cry. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord, well, in many places, one may still be afraid for their safety at night. Certainly, throughout human history, you might have had reason to have apprehension in approaching the night. Maybe that was a night time that was more dangerous because people may be going around under cover of darkness who could do you harm. The night was fearful in that sense, but in a spiritual sense as well. the night could be a long and lonely place. Perhaps you might encounter something spiritually in the night that would be to one's detriment. Perhaps you could face a despair or a temptation that you couldn't resist. That would be something that would be dangerous to your soul. And so praying to be kept and held in safety through the darkness would have been maybe a very pressing concern for people.
So if you were a celibate monk, for example, and one of the phantoms of the night that appear might be sexual temptation, and there's a line there about bodily stains, mm-hmm. things that we can't control in the night, mm-hmm. things do go bump.
I think that probably would have been a realistic concern for, yeah, certainly for that type of a community. If you think about what night represents in many ways in all types of mythology, night being the time when mischievous things come out and that might lure you away from where you should be. You know, you wouldn't want to be a traveler on the road at night. You know, you might be led astray in some way. In our current lifestyle, maybe that just sounds a bit archaic, but at the same time, there's a real reality. There's something kind of very primal, very archetypal about us, that the nighttime and the dark might be things that would present danger to us, and that we should be aware, and to take an active stance of prayer would be the natural resort for a devout person. So I'll be taking this in my prayers and have these things in my memory, these prayers to say, these things to remember. Keep me as the apple of an eye. Hide me under the shadow of thy wings. Preserve us, O Lord, while waking, and guard us while sleeping, that awake we may watch with Christ, and asleep we may rest in peace. It's such an intimate type of prayer, really, that you're committing even your sleep to God. At some point, there's a sleep that we don't physically wake up from. We want our night's rest to be peaceful, but also we pray in earnest that our soul would be prepared for its eternal rest as well. Lord Almighty, come and scatter the darkness of our hearts by the light of your presence, that we may know you, the light of the world, and the one true God, blessed this night and forevermore. Amen.
So what is it about that you enjoy reading it?
That image of scatter the darkness of our hearts by the light of your presence. Often we can feel low, we can feel despairing, we can feel discouraged, angry, all of the things that can go on in our heart, and to say to God, scatter the darkness, is just like if you brought a small light into a dark room, that small light would make a big difference. And so God, even with your presence, you scatter the dark things that even I struggle to explain or to overcome myself, and then help me to know you, help me to know that light.
Evensong by Cherry Smith. The way evening comes in, or on, or down, brings the word closer than it's ever been. The blue leveling, deeper. Evening to a fade that seems to make the color brighter, the best possible way to age. I keep watching its beauty as if I could learn it. Shaking a month's dust from a carpet out of the top window, my face paused in the cold air, joining indigo, the lidless city, invulnerable, the universe, heard.
We've almost reached the end of the night, thanks to Gerald O'Brien, Francis Matthews, Lucy Caldwell, Victoria Kennefic, Alan Finn at Radio Kerry, Brendan Rehill, Annie Atkins, Jane Clark, Poetry Ireland, Abigail Sines, and Cherry Smith. Thanks to our readers, Yvonne Cullen and David O'Mara. And thanks to Landless for filling our mornings, noons, and nights with song. And we have one more from them. Robert Herrick's poem, The Hag, is a fearful tale of mischief. The hag and the devil ride about together at what the poet calls the noon of night. And so we'll tear across the skies with them into the night, though ne'er so foul be the weather. Good night.
The hag is astride this night. The devil and she together, through thick and through thin, now out and then in, though ne'er so foul be the weather. No beast for his food dares now hushed in his lair he lies lurking, while mischiefs by his on land and on seas at noon of night are working.
Nice. The final episode in the series, Morning, Noon and Night, was presented and produced by Regan Hutchins. The entire series is available to podcast from RTE Podcasts and from the usual podcast providers. Search for The Lyric Feature Podcast. We welcome your comments and observations by email, lyric.features@rte.ie.